I'll probably have the, well, I'm going to have this one here, and there'll probably be, well, I don't know, one or two more, something like that, before we move on to something else. But our passage for tonight is from Matthew chapter 1, verse 23, talking about God with us. And Matthew chapter 1, verse 23 is where Jesus, by prophecy, was given the name Emmanuel. It comes from the Old Testament in the book of Isaiah, and it literally means God with us. Now, the study is really about several things connected with the deity of Christ. But tonight we're going to be looking at passages that are found in the book of Hebrews. A few years ago, I remember reading an article in one of our Brotherhood papers. And the remark was made how the book of Hebrews contains one of the most comprehensive expressions of the doctrine of Jesus to be found anywhere in any New Testament book. Now, of course, outside of the gospel accounts. And I think that's especially true. And just by looking at Hebrews chapter 1, there's so much information there proving that Jesus was and is deity. An interesting thing about the very first part of the book of Hebrews, chapter 1 is presenting Jesus as the Son of God and presenting him as deity. But chapter 2 has the other side of the coin. It presents Jesus as the Son of Man and discusses in great detail about his humanity. And of course, he was both. But we're not interested really tonight in the part about his humanity in chapter 2. We're interested in things said about his deity in chapter 1. So that's where we're going to be spending most of our time. Now we'll look at a few other things, most of them from the New Testament as well. But I've got several points here for us to consider. And the first one is that Jesus is the Son of God. In chapter 1 of Hebrews, in verses 1 and 2, we find that God speaks to us today through His Son. And that's in contrast to how God spoke through the fathers and the prophets. And you find that in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1 and 2, all that said in there. And the interesting thing about this is people at this time would not have to have almost arm-twisting persuasion to get them to believe either in the deity or the humanity of Jesus Christ. I think sometimes we're so far removed from that time that maybe it's a little bit more difficult with us now. But one of the things that you can find is that the Jews understood what Son of God meant. Now, it's not just saying that, well, it's talking about your immediate ancestor. You know, if someone were to say that I'm the son of Clarence, that's my dad's first name. No, it wouldn't mean something like that when it calls him the Son of God. It means far more than that. And the people at this time would understand that it meant more than that. Now, I just want to go to one place to show you how this works. Look at John chapter 5. In John chapter 5, and in verse 18. Now, about Jesus, it says here that therefore, now all this has been working up, you know, these things proving that he's the Son of God. The Jews sought the more to kill him, because he not only had broken the Sabbath, but said also that God was his Father. That'd make him the Son, right? And what else? Making himself equal with God. So they understood perfectly well what all this meant. If he's the Son of God, God's his Father, that means that he's equal with God. And again, I think this is something that sometimes, I think it sometimes eludes us. when we think about this. And we have to have perhaps that kind of arm-twisting persuasion to acknowledge Jesus as the Son of God, but not so much in the first century. And you can see that time and again in a number of places. But also, it goes on, and look at the last part of verse 2. Whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds. Now, the first, we want to look at this, whom he appointed heir of all things. So now, Jesus is the heir of all things. And there you find it stated in Hebrews chapter 1 and in verse 2. But now, here's something else. In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 10, it says that for whom are all things? Right there at the beginning of it. Now, that's for Jesus. There we are, all things. And I think that this falls in with everything else when you think about it because, well, all things were created for him. Colossians chapter 1 and verse 16. For by him were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created by him and for him. So once again, you know, he's the heir of all things. Jesus is Lord over all. We're told here that he's got dominion over everything which has been created. You see that there in Colossians chapter 1, verse 16. He's covering everything. He's got dominion over all that. Man has not really got the dominion over things. Not like Jesus. Not like man thinks that he does. I think what man needs to do, I think what a lot of times, what would stop a lot of things, maybe help a lot of problems that we've got in the world today, and yet right here, you know, at home, is for people to go back and take a look at Genesis and see that man was created to be the caretaker of what God had brought into existence, the caretaker. And somehow or another, we've lost sight of that. I mean, mankind has. And we've decided that, well, we've got to have dominion over everything. Mankind has decided that rather than be the caretaker of what God has created, man in his quote-unquote wisdom has decided that he's the big cheese and has dominion over everything and thinks to himself that nothing could possibly exist and exist well without man's interference. Man needs to get back to just being a caretaker of the things that God has created. Jesus is the creator. You also see that in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 2. And John said at the beginning of his gospel account that all things, there wasn't a thing that wasn't created by him. John chapter 1 verse 3, all things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. That's just a pretty absolute statement, isn't it? Of course it is. And then we saw that in Colossians chapter 1, verse 16, just a moment ago, what Paul had said about this, over everything, completely and totally. And you ask yourself, now how's that possible? Even in the first century, they would know when Jesus was born. They would know that. And creation happened sometime before that. Well beyond what you would think was the normal span of a lifetime. And several centuries before Jesus came into existence. So how's all that possible? That could come to the mind and the memory. But now, we went over this in another lesson, and we'll look at it again just briefly back here in Genesis chapter 1. And in verse 1, this is how this works. It says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, we follow up on this, and we come down here, and we find, you know, that after just a little bit, you find God being spoken of here in a plurality. You know, verse 26 of chapter 1, let us, God's saying this, let us make man in our image. There's more than one there. And the word there is Elohim in the Hebrew, and that's a plural word. Now, the only way that this can be explained is by understanding that Jesus is the God, the Elohim, of Genesis 1. And he was there at the beginning. And so many things that, well, we've already looked at. And that's the only possible explanation of this. Now, Hebrews chapter 1, you flip back over there. And look at verse 3 where it says, who being the brightness of his glory. Now, you might have a different word than brightness. People have kind of struggled with what word to use there. There's one translation that decided to use a word that's accurate. It's effulgence. And I thought to myself, well, while that might be a good word and everything, I got an idea. That's just not a word I've used this month. Have you used that, you know? I mean, it's a word we're not familiar with. But it's an attempt to get the idea across here, what this means. But brightness of his glory works well enough. And when you think about how what that means the best explanation would be something like this. As we see the sun because of its own radiance. Now, we see a lot of other things up there in the sky, especially of a night. But we see that. But that's a reflection is what we're seeing. You know, the moon doesn't put off any kind of light. Regardless of what people have said and how many wonderful songs have been sung, there's really no such thing as moonlight over Vermont or any place else. No, it doesn't have its own light. It reflects light. And all these other bodies that you see, the stars and the skies, they're reflecting light. But the sun, as a star, has its own light. Now, Jesus is reflecting this, or not reflecting, is producing this light, and that's the light that's shining. That's the shine that radiates from him. And when we see the light radiating from him, it's like we're seeing the radiance of God as well. In John chapter 1 and verse 18, no man hath seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. And so you could say that his radiance, the radiance of Jesus, is declaring also the radiance of God. In John chapter 12 and verse 45, he that seeth me seeth him that sent me. Well, that's not the only time Jesus says something like that. As a matter of fact, we'll look at another one here, which I think goes right along with this idea of the brightness, that he's the express image of his person. Now, this is from the word there, express image, or just image, or whatever a more modern, I've got the King James, whatever more modern translation might have there. Now, originally, this was a word that meant an engraving tool. That's the original meaning. Now, an engraving tool. If you've ever had a name embossed on a leather book or something made out of leather, they take those tools, you know, and they'll take, it's got a letter on the end of it, and they'll hit that, and whatever's on that engraving tool, that's what it'll look like down there, only it'll be turned around the other way. Now, and we had these at work that had hardened tips and all, and we use them to mark tools. And you know, you struck that with a hammer and it left that mark. So the word here, it's a word that's literally character. And I always think to myself, how about a typewriter? The old typewriters, the keys. And when that key came up there and struck the paper, you know what we would say that was putting on the paper? a character. And so it's the tool that does that. But then later on, it, what would you want to say? It kind of changed over to become the image that was made as well as the tool that made it. So Jesus is the express image of His person, God being the tool and Jesus being the mark that's made. And so, you know, the whole idea is here not to create some theological firestorm with the with what's used and all, but I think it's to show exactness. Now, you know, because it leaves an exact image. And it does that with the engraving tools, with the typewriter, with other things of that nature. Now, we looked at John chapter 1 and verse 18, but now there's more that we can see on this. And John also, John chapter 14, verses 8 and 9, Philip says, "Lord, show us the Father and it will suffice us." In other words, it will satisfy us. But Jesus says unto him, "Have I been so long time with you, Philip, and yet hast thou not known me, Philip? He that hath seen me hath seen the Father. And how sayest thou then, show us the Father? You look at me." Well, that's good enough. You see me, you see the Father. Exact image. Well, that's right. That's what that means. Colossians chapter 1 there, and verse 15, it says, speaking of Jesus, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature. Now we move on to another point here in Hebrews, this time in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3 again. We'll look at how Jesus is the sustainer of creation. In the middle of the passage, it says, the King James has, upholding all things by the word of His power. Upholding all things. And some translations, there's one or two, that have the word sustaining in there. In other words, He's keeping things going. Now you think about this. Now again, we're talking about beings with powers that we can't imagine. To be able to create everything. To think of how powerful God would be if He can just say, "Let there be light," and there's light. Now I'm telling you what, that's power. No matter what you want to, how you want to look at it, that's power. And let there be this and let there be that. And it says, and it was. And then we think about Jesus being in on the creation. And not only being in on the creation of things, it says here He's the sustainer of all things. He keeps everything going. And when you think about the balance of things that we live in, it's just, you know, it's really something. What is it now? You know, you read this article that surfaces every once in a while about how everything is just right. Everything's just right for us here on the earth. We are the exact distance away from the sun so we don't burn up or freeze to death. We're going the right speed for gravity to be able to keep us on. If we went a little faster, I mean, we'd be out of here. If it went a little slower, well, we'd just be mashed down there, you know. And it just, and on with things like this, you know. And it's just fantastic to realize, you know, the intricate complexity of all these things working together. Sounds like a creator, doesn't it? It sure does. And so many people want to say, well, it just happened by some cataclysmic accident, an explosion or something. Really. Like you could go over here. Now, not the Home Depot where Martha works. But you could go to a Home Depot and put a ginormous bomb in there and blow it up. Blow it up. And when the smoke and everything cleared, you'd have a nice 3-bedroom house in there. Believe that? I don't believe that neither. I don't believe either story. But anyway, Jesus, the sustainer, having this power to be able to keep all these things going, the seasons, everything. But then, we can back this up with something that we find in Colossians again. Colossians chapter 1 and verse 17. He is before all things, and by Him all things consist. They're here, and they're kept here, they're sustained here, they're upheld. All things done by Jesus Christ. You move down to Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 8. But unto the Son He saith, Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of Thy kingdom. So He's saying to the Son, Thy throne, O God. So it's addressing Jesus as God. But then, isn't that the thing over in John chapter 1 and verse 1? In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. And you read down just a few passages after that, and you find out the Word that's being discussed there, well, that's Jesus Christ. So the Word was with God, the Word was God in the beginning? Yeah. And a number of other things that we've looked at in different points. Now, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 10 through 12. And Thou, Lord, in the beginning hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of Thy hands. They shall perish, but Thou remainest, and they all shall wax old as doth a garment. And as a vesture shalt Thou fold them up, and they shall be changed. But Thou art the same, and Thy years shall not fail. So, one of the things that we learn from this is Jesus is Jehovah. Here in these passages, you find a quotation taken from Psalms chapter, the 102nd Psalm, verse 25 and 27. Now you go over there and you look at this and you see, well, yeah, that's those passages over there for sure. But now when you look at, and these passages now, these are applied to Jesus, the Lord there in Psalm 102. But now if you back up a little bit, verses 21 and 22, it says, to declare the name of the Lord in Zion and His praise in Jerusalem, when the people were gathered together in the kingdoms to serve the Lord. Now in both cases, the King James Version has the words Lord, all capitals. All capital letters. And that was how they did this when they came across the word Jehovah. It's what was said at the burning bush. When Moses said, who am I going to say has sent me? And the response that comes across in English is, tell them that I am have sent you. I am that I am. Yahweh. Y-H-W-H. That's how the Hebrew letters, that's what the word would look like. Now this was anglicized into an English word of Jehovah. And so, does that mean then that Jesus is the Jehovah of the Old Testament? Well, yeah, that's what it would be implying here. But it also is pointing out that He is still deity in all this. And yeah, you know, the Lord's being discussed in 21 and 22, Jehovah, and then those passages are applied to Jesus. So, I mean, just what's the conclusion? I don't see any other conclusion on that. And I don't see that's any reason to be alarmed at something like this. Now, verse 11 of chapter 1 of Hebrews. You look at this, they shall perish, but Thou remainest. They all shall wax old as doth a garment. Well, Jesus is eternal, is what it means there. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. John chapter 1, verse 1. Now, elsewhere in Hebrews, we'll go over to chapter 7. Let me get it up there. Let me catch up here. There we go. Hebrews chapter 7, verses 16 and 17. Hebrews chapter 7, verses 16 and 17. who is made not after the law of a carnal commandment, but after the power of an endless life, for he testifieth, thou, and that would be Jesus, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. The power of an endless life. Now this is how Jesus remains a high priest. You know, the high priest in Israel, that would be after the priesthood of Judah and after Aaron and Judah, the tribe of Judah. When a priest died, Aaron died. You go back to the Old Testament and find that Aaron died. And what did they do? Well, they made one of his sons a high priest. And what happened when he died? Well, they do it again. Again and again and again, all down through history, in that priesthood, there was a successor because the priest died. But now the priesthood of Melchizedek's different. It says Melchizedek, it says in one place here, that he had neither father nor mother. There wasn't anybody before or after him. Now, a lot of people think, well, that means that one day Melchizedek just appeared out here in the desert someplace. Well, that's not what it means. It's talking about his priesthood. And he didn't succeed anyone as a priest, and no one followed after him as a priest. He was a priest, singular, by himself, the order of Melchizedek. And Jesus becomes like Melchizedek in that he's the only one. But then that makes perfect sense because you know what? Jesus lives forever. He went to heaven. Now, he couldn't be a priest here on earth, but he's a priest when he went to heaven. And he lives eternally for all time. And so he's the only high priest that there will be. Not going to be anymore. We've got the only one. But that's also in connection with his eternal nature. In Hebrews chapter 7, verses 24 and 25, this man, because he continueth ever, hath an unchangeable priesthood. Wherefore, he is able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him, seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for them. Was that true in the first century, that he ever lives to make intercession for them? Yeah. Well, now here it is, the 21st century. Who's making intercession for us? He's still doing it. Jesus is. That's what a high priest is supposed to do. And so his work hasn't stopped. Because he hasn't stopped. That's how this is. This is why, you know, with the prayers that we utter them to Jesus as our intercessor. He's going to hear us. He's going to take these before God. He's going to be there pleading our case, if you will. Because he lives forever. He's been doing that for a long time. He'll continue to do it until he returns here. When he returns here and all is gone, high priesthood role will be over then. But until then, it's something that remains. And now the last point that we're looking at tonight's in verse 12 of Hebrews chapter 1. And it's about Jesus being immutable. And really that's a nice word that means, well, thou art the same and thy years shall not fail. You know, there's no change with Jesus. That's what immutable means. And we're told at the end of the book of Hebrews, chapter 13 and verse 8, that he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. You know, you see a lot of people that might go through a change. Sometimes it's for the better. But if somebody goes through a change, even if it's for the better, it means that, you know, they're not immutable, they're actually mutable. And sometimes people go through a change and they go from something that's good to something that's not so good anymore. It's amazing. It's always amazing to me. If you ask anyone a question about who's the wisest man in the Bible, you know what we'll all say, don't you? We'll all say Solomon. That's who we'll say. Good answer. I believe that's the right answer. But isn't the irony of it that toward the end of his life, he sure didn't appear to be too wise with some of the things that he did, the choices that he made. And how these things, you know, it doesn't go without saying, I've got my tongue in my cheek now when I say this. Didn't Solomon kind of have a woman problem? Now, the women weren't the problem. Solomon was the problem about women. Yeah, I think, I always get these numbers mixed up. But you know what it is? It's the number of wives and concubines, and it's 700 and 300. Put the number wherever that goes. But now, I know this, wherever the number goes on all that, that's too many. That's too many. If it's 300, why? I think it's 300. I don't know. Anyway, if that's 300, why? How many does that work out to in a year's time? What if it's 700? What difference would it make if it was 300 or 700? Either way, it's too many. How'd all that come about? Where'd that wisdom go? What happened to it? Well, you know what? Solomon was a man who was mutable. He was changeable. Read some of the judges, about some of those judges. I mean, they're amazing characters with what they could do, and then just fail so miserably. I have a book I really like on the judges. And the title of the book is Hearts of Iron and Feet of Clay. And that describes every one of those men that you read about that was a judge over Israel. And then following after them, you get into 1 Samuel and there's Eli. Same thing. How about Samuel? We have a tendency to think that Samuel didn't have a lot of shortcomings. Yeah, he did. He had some boys. And it looked like those boys were going to be raised up to be priests, and the people said, we don't want them. They're no good. And they were no good. And Samuel apparently was part of the blame for all this. Hearts of iron, feet of clay, mutable. But we are too. But Jesus isn't. He does not change. He'll stay the same. Yesterday, today, forever. And we ought to really be glad and appreciate that fact. Well, take your songbooks, turn to the songs been selected. There are a number of other passages in Hebrews that likewise would prove that Jesus was and is deity. Now, the name that we started off with that was given to him by prophecy, by an angel of the Lord, Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. Matthew chapter 1, verse 23. Any doctrine that would teach that Jesus is just a man is error. And Jesus, through his death, one more thing we're looking at here in Hebrews chapter 1, in verse 3, it says, Jesus, through his death, has purged our sins. Some translations has brought about the purification. Well, that's right. But we need to believe in him as the Son of God. And that's really the point of this sermon and ought to be the basis of every sermon. We believe in him, we obey his gospel, and we have our sins purged. We will receive that purification. We'd be happy to help anyone in doing that today. If anyone has done that, correction needs to be made, we'd be happy to help you to do that as well. But right now, the time is to sing this song of invitation, which indicates that if you have a need to respond, that this is the right time and this is the right place. Come all together, we stand and sing.